following message is by Dr. Steve Lee of Emmanuel Community Church. More information about the ministry of Emmanuel Community Church can be found online at www.emmanuelcommunity.org.
Now, it's interesting that if you look at the latest 2010 census data, we're in uncharted territory in America today. If you look at that census data, what you discover is for the first time in this country's history, there are more adults in America that have chosen to remain single than to get married. That has never happened in the history of this country. There has always been a majority of adults who are married rather than single. But in our generation, for the first time, it seems Americans are saying, this is an unworkable ideal, this idea of marriage. And so they're just opting out of it. They're just in, you know, common law relationships or live-in relationships. And they say, listen, who knows the future? It's ridiculous to make a promise like that. Let's just enjoy it while we're in love with each other. And if we fall out of love, we'll go our separate ways and find new people that we could be, quote-unquote, in love with. And as I did last week, I mean, I know I got some feedback and said, man, you know, you're so cynical. You know, you really took, you're a killjoy. I mean, you really, you know, it just seemed like I doused any sense of a fiery romance with just cold water, you know. But I'm going to be relentless about this, you know. There's something very pernicious about this Hollywoodized fairy tale view of romantic love that I think has infiltrated the church in a lot of ways and has brainwashed us to think certain things that make it very hard for us to embrace the biblical teaching on love. This idea of love being an act of the will, you know, that kind of takes the fun out of all of it, you know. What about the romance? What about being swept off of my feet? What about my Prince Charming? What about, you know, this person that's just going to complete me and my soulmate? And all of this ends up putting this certain expectations on marriage that are unrealistic. And it's almost like a ticking time bomb setting you up for failure, you know? And we talked about in this picture of romantic love as Hollywood presents it to us, the height of that is the dating courtship period. And, you know, last week we talked a bit about that, how a lot of that is just a myth. It's a lie, okay? This idea like, that's what we have to get back to. Honey, what happened to the old us that enjoyed those strolls down the park and those quiet evenings watching a movie and having dinner, you know? It's a very unrealistic picture of what the long haul in marriage is. I was thinking it like this. If you really want a realistic picture of whether you're compatible with each other, whether you're going to make it, I think this is the ideal and perfect tell-all date. Before you go out, pull an all-nighter, okay? Neither of you sleep, all right? So now you're tired. Then come to one of our ICC families and borrow an infant and borrow a toddler, preferably one of which has a fever. Then go to a crowded restaurant and look soulfully in one another's eyes and talk about the relationship, okay? I think that's a perfect date. Okay, with a crying baby in one arm, with bloodshot eyes because you haven't slept all night, and then look and say, do I love this person, you know? And see how kind that person, okay, I'm sorry. I'm being very cynical here. Listen, I can't emphasize how much this notion of love as Hollywood presents it to us is so destructive to the Christian world. Look at every single romantic comedy, how it sets it up. The lady is always with a guy that's totally cast in this hateable way. You hate the relationship from this first act. You want them to break up because the guy is so horrible. And then along comes this person that just seems like a soulmate, bumps into a cafe or something like that. And it's like, ding, you know, that's the one. I'm living in bondage. I'm living in this horrible relationship. And somehow the whole movie is about how these two can get together against all odds. Isn't that every single rom-com that Hollywood has produced, isn't it, right? Think about that message that is sending. The bondage of commitment to somebody that you don't even love anymore and the possibilities of those butterflies in your stomach once again, living once again, being free once again with that soulmate. And I tell you, if you follow that lie, you're headed down a life of misery, not of joy. Okay? One of the things that we said about this idea of commitment in marriage is that you're stuck. You can't run, okay? is that this is going to be the most intense and inescapable relationship of your life. And as we said, one of the reasons, that's by God's design. Because one of the things that comes out then is that what you find is what you are confronting in marriage more than anything is not the problems with your spouse, but with the ugliness of your own self-centeredness that begins to emerge, okay? And it gets ugly. It gets ugly. As you take a deep, hard look at yourself, marriage becomes a mirror that casts a harsh light on who you really are. And what you discover is that when you entered marriage, your expectations were often very self-centered of what that person is going to do for you. I don't think many of us get into marriage all excited going, I can't wait for all the ways I'm planning to serve my spouse, you know? I'm going to do this for him, and I'm going to do that for her. I don't think that's the mindset of the average newlywed. It's thinking about how that person is going to satisfy all the longings of my heart, how that person is going to complete me, and then the frustration that ensues when we suddenly discover that that person's not willing to be a part of that program as readily as we thought, and going, what is your problem? Why can't you just see you can make me happy, you know? And that's what you're here for. There's actually quite a few of these international dating services that try to hook up, you know, American men with foreign women. And so here's a guy that often is somewhat successful but just hasn't found the right mate. And so these international services will take these oftentimes very destitute women from the village who are desperate for a way out. And oftentimes they look at America as the promised land. And so they'll try to hook them up. There's a big phenomenon that's happening in Korea, actually, too, right now. And the problem is that's such a lopsided relationship. And quite often what will happen is when this guy is done looking through these catalogs of women, he's pretty much largely judging just on physical appearance. Whoever he looks at, it looks like could be a beautiful wife for him. And then he'll often write a certain contract out to this woman about a list of demands that he expects for this woman. And I want you to read you an actual excerpt from one of those letters that was written to one of these women to hear about what this guy was saying his wife needs to do before he was willing to make the commitment and fly over to that country in Asia and marry her and bring her back to the States. And he wrote this to her. These are his actual words, okay? Your primary function in life is to serve me. Your secondary function is to be a model mother, but never to the extent that it will conflict with proper attention to me. You will rise approximately at 6 a.m. After going to the bathroom, brushing your teeth, combing your hair, cleaning your face with alcohol or sea breeze, you will wake the children. Each day, there will be absolute order in the house by the time that I arrive. You will clean your face no less than 3 times a day. You will immediately reply verbally when I speak to you. When we make love, I expect that you do so at any and all times and with enthusiasm. All right? That was his letter to this. Now, you listen to that and go, oh my goodness, that's beyond the pale. I mean, that's ridiculous. Okay, I admit that's an extreme form, but what I am going to argue to you is that in lesser forms, we all have this list of expectations, whether we verbalize it or not, of what our spouse will and will not do. And it is precisely when that person violates these expectations that all the trouble ensues about when they are not meeting our expectations, when they are not giving us what we desire, when they are not fulfilling the deepest longings of our heart. That's the challenge of marriage. It's the challenge of marriage. Let's take a look at the idea of sex. You know, we'll go more into sex in a couple of weeks, and we're going to hit that head on. But if you just think about sex, I mean, it's this idea like, you know, I think a lot of couples, read books, you hear these marriage seminars, you know, like men are like microwaves and women are like crock pots and all this. And so I'm sure these are familiar terms to you guys, you know. So it's this whole idea of, for a woman, the foreplay is all day. And so you have to, you know, romance her. You know, you can't just expect to jump in the second she's going to be ready, you know. As well, for guys, mostly it's like that. And so men hear all of this. And so they try. You know, you try. You try to listen to her when you don't really want to. And you try to be attentive. And all the while, what you've been told is that by the end of the day, she'll be a ready partner, ready to jump in the chair. You won't be able to keep her off of you by the end of the day. That's way overstating the case, isn't it, right? I'm sure there have been many men that tried that. And then at the end of the day, the lady still just wants to sleep. She's had a rough day with the kids. And she, I appreciate it, honey. You listen to me. Now just stay on your side of the bed and let me sleep. And what happens? You know? It didn't work. You know? Now she was supposed to be ready. I've been stewing this all day. And I've been working toward this. And there's no payoff. You know? It was a lie at that marriage enrichment seminar. It's a lie. And it's at that point that you're faced with a decision, aren't you? Forget it then. It's not worth it. Whether I'm mean to her, whether I'm nice to her, still nothing at the end of the day. So what's the point? Why even try? You see what marriage begins to do. It begins to say, why do you do what you really do? What is really motivating, and what marriage is going to uncover is that a lot of our motives are selfish. A lot of it is about what do I get at my end of the bargain. What we find is that too often couples get together primarily motivated by companionship. And what you discover at the end of the day as you get deeper into marriage is that somehow companionship is not enough. It's not enough. Something is still missing. There is a missing ingredient to make this marriage work. I want that companionship. And so why is it that so often I can feel lonely in my marriage? And that's precisely where I believe the Christian view of marriage has a lot to offer. It has a lot to say beyond mere companionship for companionship's sake. And there are two metaphors that the Bible uses primarily that we're going to use to sort of flesh out a bit of what we want to talk about here. The first is the metaphor of one flesh. One flesh. Ephesians 5:31 says, "For this reason, a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and the two will become one flesh." Now, again, this is using ancient imagery and ancient language that probably confuses the average modern hearer. I mean, what do you picture when you hear that you and your wife or you and your husband are going to become one flesh? What picture does that conjure in your mind? I mean, it's hard to wrap your mind around it, okay? I don't know, do you picture some grotesque bodily meld or something like that? I mean, I don't know what you imagine when you talk about two people becoming one. Too often, this word flesh is equated with this, you know, your physical body. So we think about flesh versus the spirit. But when the Bible uses the word flesh, what it really is basically meaning is just person, one person, okay? Not necessarily your physical body. So what the Bible is saying here, he's quoting Genesis 2:24, what God has said about the nature of marriage. And what God is saying is this: when a man and a woman commit themselves in the promise of marriage, what happens in a mysterious way is that two individuals come together, and in that marriage, they actually form one individual, one person, one being. An entirely new being is created out of... Are we okay here? Okay. An entirely new being is formed out of that commitment. And it's talking about the depth of intimacy that'll exist between husband and wife. And it's interesting, Paul uses the exact same metaphor that he used to talk about the church and Jesus Christ. What in essence he says is that the husband is the head and the wife is the body. But together, it's just one body. Okay? And that is going to be the teaching out of which a lot of what we understand about Christian marriage is going to flow. The husband and wife are now one in an inextricably inseparable way. They have now become one. And what is the implication of that for the way that we begin to relate with one another? The second metaphor is this. Although Paul doesn't explicitly say it, what it is it says in Genesis 2:25, right after talking about the one flesh unity, what it says is, the man and his wife were both naked and they felt no shame. They were naked and they felt no shame. This was the nature of marriage before the fall. This was also the nature of our relationship with God before the fall. Adam and Eve were completely naked, and yet they had nothing to hide, nothing to fear. And this is again where we see marriage as sacrament, is that what God was trying to say is, just as you can be before me naked and unashamed, there's nothing to hide, we have a perfectly intimate relationship, we know each other, we accept each other. In marriage, as a husband and wife are naked physically with each other, it was supposed to represent that relationship with God. And so as you can see here, we're not just talking about physical nakedness here, are we? We're talking about something much deeper than that. It's this idea of being fully known and yet fully accepted. And I believe that is the universal longing of every person's heart, is to be fully known, naked, exposed. Let everything that I am be seen for what it is, and yet no shame. I'm not embarrassed about it. Why? Because that person who has seen my nakedness accepts me, receives me. That is a picture of marriage. Okay? That is to be a picture of marriage. The two people come to form one person in an incredibly deep and intimate way. And in that intimacy, you will become naked to each other. You expose yourself to one another. And in that exposure, there is embrace and acceptance and love. I see you for who you are. And I love that person that I see. And that was to picture our relationship with God, how God sees us. Now, the problem is we get into sin. And when sin entered the picture, there was shame. That's one of the first comments that is made in the book of Genesis, is that when Adam and Eve sinned, it says that they realized that they were naked and they were ashamed of their nakedness. And so the first reaction to sin entering their lives is to hide, to cover up. Now they have something to be embarrassed about. Now they have something that they don't want seen. That becomes the fundamental problem. And I've said this in numerous sermons. When sin enters, you can't have both. You don't get to have full exposure and full acceptance. You have to pick one or the other. You can either hide and cover yourself up and create an image of yourself that you think is acceptable to others, and then people will buy into that image and accept you. Or you can reveal yourself for who you really are and be honest with others, and it tends to turn people off. They get disgusted. They go, oh, man, I don't want to hang out with that person. But what we find is that in the cross of Jesus Christ, the message there is, I see you for all of your ugliness, all of the filth, all of the dirt. I have seen that. But because of what Christ has done on the cross, I accept you just as you are. I love you. Even while you were yet sinners, I died for you. That's the message of the gospel. And I'm arguing to you that that is also the message that must be recaptured in marriage. Again, that's how we reflect our relationship with God, is the person that you're marrying has a lot of faults, a lot of flaws. And what is happening in the marriage arrangement is this. It's sort of the picture of the wedding night, if you think, and it's, it's sort of like your whole life you were sort of taught that you got to cover yourself up physically, that, you would never walk around nude. But then suddenly you get to your wedding night, and you have to reverse that all in a single night. And if some of you can sort of go back to that time, if you've experienced that, you know what a shock that is. Suddenly this body that was meant to be covered up has to be exposed for my partner. And now you're looking at each other naked, and you go into a whole new place with that, don't you, right? It's a whole uncharted territory. Is what you're saying, that's very symbolic what happens on that wedding night. When you show your nakedness to your spouse, now, you could stop there at that day and go, whoa, hold on here. I didn't know this is what I was getting. And you can reject each other. You can walk away. No, of course that doesn't happen, right? What happens on that wedding night is, in essence, you give the gift of your nakedness to your partner. And in that embrace is symbolizing something very important spiritually, which is to say, I am going to be completely naked before you. And we need to accept one another in what we see. And what I'm saying is this. The uniqueness of your marriage relationship is that you will expose yourself to your spouse in ways that you will not to any other person. No one else will have the level of exposure that your spouse does. Okay? Whether you want to or not, your spouse will see you in your worst days. Your spouse will see you when you're off your guard, when you're not on your game, when you've had a bad day. Your spouse will see it all. But that is part of the design of marriage, naked and unashamed. And in that acceptance of the other person, in the midst of the ugliness that we see in that nakedness, becomes a picture of the gospel that we need to give to one another. But the problem is this. It is so hard to do that. It is so hard to do that. All too often, when the nakedness of your spouse gets exposed to you, instead of acceptance, instead of love, often what it's met with is contempt and anger and disgust and self-righteous judgment. How come she always does that? He did it again. I can't handle it anymore. And let me say this. Nobody can hurt you like your spouse. Why? Because all that nakedness provides an unbelievable amount of ammunition for the other person. There is no argument like a marriage argument, right? Because everyone knows that. Are we going to go there? Because if you want to go there, I can go there, you know? That's the problem with marriage, isn't it? Is we all know there's a threshold, you know? And you go, if you want to cross that, I've got words to say to you, you know? That's the problem with this nakedness. In the nakedness, your spouse has seen it all. You can't hide anything from him or her. And now you're left with a choice. I can actually take that nakedness and be like Christ and love that person and accept them and affirm the unconditional love. Or I could turn around against them and use it as a weapon and destroy them because of that nakedness. And all too often, married couples make the wrong choice. And the problem is, once you start going down that road, you begin to leave some scars in your partner that become almost irreversible. They're so deep. And that's one of the things I say often in marriage counseling. Yeah, I've done some counseling, not a whole lot, but I've done some marriage counseling with some older couples. And I think I've shared this before with you. I mean, sometimes the things that they dredge up about what their spouse said to them dates back decades ago, and yet they share it as if it was just said yesterday. The pain is that deep, and the wounds are that fresh, you know? These snide remarks or hurtful words that were said in the heat of the moment, when you were just so angry at that person. And those have left a searing scar in your spouse that can last for decades. Okay? That nakedness that is experienced in marriage creates an incredibly volatile situation. And you have that choice to make what you do with that nakedness. John Ortberg writes this in an interesting way. I have a visual representation here. You know where I'm going already, don't you? The North American common porcupine is a member of the rodent family that has around 30,000 quills attached to his body. Each quill can be driven into an enemy, and the enemy's body heat will cause the microscopic barb to expand and become more firmly embedded. The wounds can fester. The more dangerous ones, affecting vital organs, can be fatal. The porcupine is not generally regarded as a lovable animal. The Latin name, Erythizon dorsatum, means the irritable back. And they all have one. Books and movies celebrate almost every conceivable animal. Not just dogs and cats and horses, but also pigs, spiders, Charlotte's Web, dolphins, Flipper, bears, Gentle Ben, and killer whales, Free Willy, okay? Even skunks have Pepe Le Pew. I don't know of any famous porcupines. I don't know any child who has had one for a pet. As a general rule, porcupines have two methods for handling relationships: withdrawal and attack. They either head for a tree or stick out their quills. They are generally solitary animals. Wolves run in packs. Sheep huddle in flocks. We speak of herds of elephants and gaggles of geese and even a murder of crows. But there is no special name for a group of porcupines. They travel alone. Porcupines don't always want to be alone. In the late autumn, a young porcupine's thoughts turn to love. But love turns out to be a risky business when you're a porcupine. Females are open to dinner and a movie only once a year. The window of opportunity closes quickly. And a girl porcupine's no is the most widely respected turndown in all the animal kingdom. Fear and anger make them dangerous little creatures to be around. This is the porcupine's dilemma. How do you get close without getting hurt? Okay? I actually think that's a very wonderful picture of us, you know? We're all just lonely porcupines going, why won't anyone hug me? And we get these quills just staring down people, you know? This idea, everyone toots up back, says, this one's dangerous, you know? This is the issue, isn't it? This is what marriage is about again. Sorry to keep pouring cold water on all your hopes and dreams, you know? I think we're going to have a lot more celibate people in our church after this series, maybe, but just this idea that we want to be close to people, but why is it so hard? Why is it so hard? Why is it that I want intimacy? I want companionship. And yet the very one that was intended to be my partner, I find attacking all the time. I can't resist myself. Those quills come out. And immediately I'm on the attack. And here's the picture, is this idea that's saying, you two will come together and form one. And out of that one, there is a picture of nakedness. In that nakedness is full exposure. And in that exposure must be embrace, must be acceptance, must be a mutual agreement that I've seen your darkest moments. I've seen the deepest ugliness of your soul. And yet, nevertheless, I accept you. I love you. There is no need for shame in this relationship. That is a healthy marriage. Another message that has to be given here is in this idea of a one flesh unity, it's to say we're in this together. This is not about me against you, but it's saying that no matter what difficulties we're going through, we're on the same team, we're the same body. And what Paul is trying to say is in the exact same way that you think about yourself, that's what you need to translate to your spouse. As he says, each one of you must love his wife as he loves himself. And this is what the whole body imagery is for. You know, like if you hurt your arm, you don't just go like, oh, well, that's my arm. I don't really care about it. It's my arm, you know? Any part of your body that hurts, you become intensely concerned about. You become incredibly attentive. And this is what the one flesh unity is saying is, in the same selfishness I feel toward me, I now include my wife, my husband, in that picture. In that, whatever they do, however they wrong me, whatever happens, it's not about me against her, me against him. But it's this continual message, we are one. We're in this together. And this is the problem, is in that nakedness, it is so hard to love that person. It's like hugging a porcupine, you know? It's just this picture of, I want to love. I do, I really do. You know, this is how we think of ourselves. I really want to love that person, but she just makes it so hard. He makes it so difficult to love him, to love her. And the question is, in the midst of that nakedness, in the midst of that exposure, where do we find the strength to love like that? And it gets back to this one body metaphor, because what Paul is really saying is, you know, as hard as you find to love people when you see what they're really like, saying the one person that you are able to do that with is who? Yourself. Yourself. You have no problem loving yourself, taking care of yourself, despite all the ugliness you see in yourself. You need to be able to do that with your spouse. C.S. Lewis talked about this in his own confessional writings, where he talked about how hard he encountered this Christian teaching of love the sinner, hate the sin. And he said, that's impossible. How does anyone do that? How can you really hate the sin but love the sinner? And C.S. Lewis was struggling with this about some of the judgments that he had about certain people in his life and all the difficulty he had accepting people in light of their failures. And this is what he eventually said. It occurred to me that there was one man to whom I had been doing this all my life, namely myself. However much I might dislike my own cowardice or conceit or greed, I went on loving myself. There had never been the slightest difficulty about it. In fact, the very reason why I hated the things was that I loved the man. Just because I loved myself, I was sorry to find that I was the sort of man who did those things. You see, he says, I had no problem acting out of self-interest. In everything, in all my disappointments, in all the ways I failed, in all the ugliness that I encountered. In fact, it was my very love of self that caused me to hate the sin, that caused me to want to change. And he says, it is this attitude, this approach with which you need to see the faults in your spouse. It's not, I can't stand her. She always does that. As if it's me against him, me against her. But it is in this idea of we are one body, one person, one flesh. If she fails, I fail. If he does something wrong, we both have done something wrong. We are one in this. And so it is out of a desperate, selfish interest of restoration, reconciliation, and forgiveness that a husband and wife engages as a partnering relationship to reinforce and strengthen that which is going weak. In the same way, husbands ought to love their wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. After all, no one ever hated his own body, but he feeds and cares for it just as Christ does the church. Gary Thomas says this, "I believe one of marriage's primary purposes is to teach us how to forgive." What I said last week, your spouse will hurt you again and again and again in the course of your marriage. Your spouse will disappoint you again and again and again. But the commitment of marriage is to say, we are one person now. And when you hurt, I hurt. We are in this together. You are not my enemy. But just as selfishly as I can be for myself, I am selfish for us, for this relationship, for you. One final thing, and we'll close on this, is that another teaching, another implication that comes out of this is this image of washing. It is out of this metaphor of the body that then Paul continues on it and says, just as you wash your body, so also as a married couple, as one body, you need to wash yourselves. You need to take baths in this new body, this new identity that you've been given. And what that's talking about is the purifying, cleansing process of marriage. And what I'm saying is this. In the nakedness, I think what happens all too often is that in the earlier years, you know, you do go there. You do get into those run-ins. You do say those things that hurt one another. And after repeated arguments like this, where you're hurting each other, wounding each other, after a while, I think fatigue sets in. And you're like, I don't know how we're going to make it through this marriage if we're at each other's necks all the time like this. And I think all too often what happens in a marriage is not necessarily reconciliation and embrace and acceptance, but it's a cold war, you know? It's sort of this decision, this mutual agreement of, aren't we both a little tired of this all the time? And you know, like, you know, everything you say about me is true, and everything I say about you is true too. But where does that get us? Just a bunch of hurt feelings and cold nights, you know? So what it is it's saying is, listen, let's make a mutual agreement. You don't go there, and I won't go there, and we'll be fine, okay? And I think a lot of couples settle on that. The problem is this. It's a sort of saying, you know, if you open up that can of worms, I got a whole utility belt here of stuff ready to go on the fly. So, you know, it's just, you know, you know, it's like, so it's a stalemate, isn't it? It's like, you know, in the 90s during the whole Cold War era, right? You know, it's the mutually assured destruction, right? There's enough ballistic missiles pointing both ways that, you know, it's going to be scorched earth. You know, it's, you know, let's unleash the hounds of, you know, war, and we'll all kill each other, you know? So it's like, listen, let's just both shut our mouths and not say anything. The problem is, maybe superficially, it seems like there's more peace in that relationship. But the problem is, you don't grow anymore. You stop growing as a couple. You don't challenge one another. You don't cleanse one another. You're not sharpening each other. You just have a mutual agreement to leave each other alone. And the picture that Paul is giving here is, in this body metaphor, it's this idea of take baths, wash yourself. There's a lot of filth. There's a lot of dirtiness in this new body. And so part of the process of marriage is the sanctifying process of cleansing, of cleaning each other. And again, that's where it has to come to this idea of the way that you clean yourself is the way that you would clean your own body. Not with a rough Brillo pad, you know? But with a gentle loofah, okay? It's this picture of, you know, we've got a lot of sensitive parts on this body. And if you go at it all wrong, it's going to get ugly really fast. But it says, clean this body as if it was your own body. In other words, the way that you deal with the sin in your spouse is the way you would want your own sin to be treated, with gentleness and kindness and understanding. You know, it's, to me, the picture that I get is like, have you ever let someone else cut your nails really short? I don't know. Maybe it's just some me. I don't know if there's this universal thing. But I can never let anyone cut my nails, because if you ever cut your nails too short, you know that feeling, right? Yeah, you know, everything you touch is just so painful. And I've never cut my children's nails. I can't do it, you know. So Betty always cuts our kids' nails, you know, but the thought of cutting someone else's nails is like that, right? Is you're cutting in, you have such a narrow margin of error. And if you just go a little too deep, you get into that nail bed, and now you expose the sensitive skin, and it's just this constant throbbing pain. And I think that's the picture. It's this. It's sort of like this picture of cutting one another's nails. You're sort of sticking your hand out, and you're praying to God that the person does it gently and with sensitivity. And it's that picture that we're given in this idea of sanctifying marriage, is that the exact same way that you would want to be treated, and the deeper message is the same way that God treats you. Do you understand that? Just as Christ is the head of the church and treats you with gentleness and understanding and patience and love, as I think about how God has treated me as my head, that is how I need to treat my spouse, with mutual love, mutual respect, mutual understanding. And I think that's the picture that we need to see here, found in Ephesians 5, is this idea as husband and wife come together as one flesh. There is this amazing, mystical, mysterious union in which these two will now become so intimate, they will form one organism, one person. And in that formation of one person is the picture of being completely naked and yet completely unashamed. And it's that picture that, as deep as that intimacy gets, it creates an incredibly volatile situation to allow us to turn on one another if we choose to do so. But the message is this: just as Christ treats me, just as he is ready to forgive again and again and is patient and enduring with me, this is the way I need to treat my spouse. Let's pray. As we continue to think about this message of marriage, I'm just going to give you opportunity to reflect. I think we're at many different stages in our church. I think we represent almost the whole gamut of our relationships with the opposite sex. Whether some of you are young and single, some of you are engaged, some of you are newly married, some of you have been married for quite some time. Some of you are separated. Some of you are divorced. Some of you are widowed. And I want to say that in the bigger picture of things, all of you are welcome in our church. And I don't want any of you to feel like somehow because of your marital status or something that you're somehow an outcast or that you don't belong. And I think one of the real important messages here is that, you know, I don't want to take away anything from what I'm saying about the importance of marriage in our spiritual development. And on the other hand, I want to say I don't want there to be a message that says unless you're married, you know, somehow your life is not complete and you'll never be a complete person. You know, because as we've been saying all along, the whole purpose of marriage is to picture incompletely and imperfectly our perfect union with Christ. And if you're a believer in Christ, you have that. And in that knowledge, there's nothing that's incomplete about you, regardless of your marital status. But nevertheless, I don't want that message to diminish the fact that marriage is incredibly important in God's eyes. What, in essence, marriage is asking you to do is to give yourself to another person in a way that you've never had to give yourself before. And that's so difficult. And it blows out of the water this silly, fairy tale, Hollywoodized version of romantic love that is so cheap, that is so superficial, that is so self-centered, about finding your prince charming, finding your princess that's going to sweep you off your feet. The picture of marriage is so much deeper, so much more profound, so much more important than that. C.S. Lewis writes, "If you want to make sure of keeping it intact, talking about your heart, you must give your heart to no one, not even an animal. Wrap it carefully round with hobbies and little luxuries. Avoid all entanglements. Lock it up safe in the casket or coffin of your selfishness. But in that casket, safe, dark, motionless, airless, it will change. It will not be broken. It will become unbreakable, impenetrable, irredeemable." And I think this is the fundamental choice that every one of us faces, is we can choose to lock our hearts in the coffin of protection and say, no one is going to hurt me. Or you can take that risk and be naked and exposed and choose to love as an act of the will, regardless of how many times others may hurt you. But in the pain of that relationship will blossom a whole new you, a whole new heart that you never knew before. And I think that is the fundamental invitation that we're being given in marriage. So can I just invite you, as the worship team closes out in a song, just to pray to the Lord and say, God, whatever stage you may be, whether you're single, engaged, newly married, married for quite some years, like I said, separated, divorced, widowed, would you just lift your heart up to the Lord and say, God, I do long for companionship. I want that companionship, and yet I see the forces working in my heart so often to push people away, to stew in my own misery and self-pity, and all the ways in which I seem to destroy the very things that I long for around me. Say, give me a heart like yours. Give me a heart that is able to love, that isn't so self-centered, but that is giving and generous and kind. And Lord, the only way that I can do that is if I see that in you, that you are my head. You are the one that looks over me in that way. So let's just pray that for a few minutes and ask God to open up our eyes to see how he treats us, the way he regards us, so that out of the overflow of thankfulness and gratitude for that relationship we have in Christ, we have the strength to love others in the way that he treats us. Let's pray.